Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to episode 257 of TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV Podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor here, and I'm joined as always by the great Dan Feinberg, The Hollywood Reporter's chief TV critic. How's it going, Dan?
It goes. Happy 25th birthday, Leslie. Big milestone 25th birthday to my partner in crime, Leslie Goldberg here. Hope you had a good one.
Thank you. Yeah, I celebrated so much, it was like seeing double.
That requires our listeners to do math or to know how old you are. Leslie is a spring chicken, is all we're saying.
Yes, sure. Absolutely. Positively. I'll just ignore all these gray hairs then.
Nothing to be done. It is something, you know, look, Steve Martin had white hair when he was 25, so doesn't mean anything at all. Yeah, and a quick apology to our dedicated listeners for missing last week. It was a combination of travel and busyness and
a slow news cycle, yeah.
Exactly. Lots and lots of reasons. Sometimes you feel like you need to force a podcast, and other times you're just like, eh. So
we'll try to have fewer weeks with eh. But yes, thank you for your patience.
We're only two people. There's only so much we can do. We are not the makers of TV news. We are the reporters of TV news. So,
well, one of us is.
Yes, I am not even that. So
no.
Oh, well.
You are the bearer of good taste, right? Or bad, yeah. That's fair. Well, let's just start off with a supersized headline. Lots to get into. Dan, why don't you kick us off?
Number one.
Absolutely. Elizabeth Banks and former TV's Top 5 guest Jessica Biel. That was for one of those things about the woman who chopped up the other woman, not the one with Elizabeth Olsen. Definitely remember that. Anyway, she was a good guest. We'll play siblings. Sure, why not? In the Amazon thriller, The Better Sister. Robin Wright will star alongside Olivia Cooke in the newly ordered Amazon drama series, The Girlfriend. And additionally, Amazon has given out an early season 2 renewal to its Alex Cross series, starring Aldous Hodge ahead of its debut, and has picked up Fallout. This was, you know, a couple weeks ago. This is what happens when you have multiple weeks without podcasts. For a second season, I remain teed off that we've got Aldous Hodge doing an Alex Cross series and not an Easy Rollins series. I've been pitching an Easy Rollins series with Aldous Hodge for years. This is still a good vehicle. And I haven't actually been pitching it to anyone, you know, like in a formal and professional way. I've just been telling social media that it should happen. And no one listens to me, but this will be fine too.
But look, you can use this podcast to pitch it, because I have certainly pitched a TV set sequel enough on this show. So,
and yet we are both apparently entirely impotent when it comes to making these things happen.
Moving on with headlines, Greg Berlanti, that slacker, is reimagining the beloved cartoon Scooby-Doo.
Scooby?
As an hour-long live-action drama series for Netflix. The writers behind the streamer's Cowboy Bebop adaptation will pen the script for the project, which has received a script-to-series commitment at the streamer. That means if the script comes in and they like it, guess what? It goes to a series. Elsewhere at the streamer, and speaking of prolific producers, Chuck Lorre will team with Leanne Morgan for an untitled multi-camera comedy series featuring the stand-up comic.
Multi-time TV's Top 5 guest, Chuck Lorre. On the unscripted side of things, Max and the linear network ID have landed U.S. rights to the Channel 4 documentary series that's billed as a, quote, forensic look at Kevin Spacey's career and allegations of inappropriate sexual conduct against him. Color me happy to let other people watch that if it's their cup of tea.
Yeah, but I mean, this is continuing a run at ID, followed by the Dan Schneider Quiet on Set documentary that they've had found a lot of success with. So not really surprising that they're leaning more into the entertainment side of things. Moving on elsewhere, Ty Burrell will star in Tightrope, a comedic version of the 1950s detective drama for Roku and executive producer Bryan Cranston.
I believe that's Tightrope exclamation point, isn't it?
Yes.
You got to pronounce the exclamation point. If you don't, then everyone's clearly going to confuse it with the, as you say, 1950s drama Tightrope, a TV show that I assure you I had never heard of before yesterday. So had you heard of Tightrope? Was it a favorite of yours?
No, I've never heard of it. But Ty Burrell is.
Of course not, because you're 25.
I love you, Dan. Please never change.
How on earth would any of our 20-something-year-old listeners have ever heard of the TV show Tightrope? That's all I'm saying.
I don't know, but you're mispronouncing it, Dan. You, too, are ignoring the exclamation point.
I thought the exclamation point was only on the new version. Is it in the old version, too?
I have no idea. All I'm saying is stop putting punctuation marks in TV show titles, period. Mostly, I'm just thinking of Bob Hart's Abishola and how some outlets still use the heart emoji in the title, which is ridiculous. Bob Hart emoji Abishola is the name of the show? No, it's Bob Loves Abishola. I don't freaking know. It's ending. It doesn't matter.
In casting, Steve Carell, who we could call Office grad or The Patient grad or Daily Show grad, lots of stuff, lots of credit for Steve Carell, will reunite with his Date Night co-star Tina Fey in the Netflix series The Four Seasons. Speaking of The Office, Greg Daniels has tapped the White Lotus breakout Sabrina Impacciatore. And Donald Gleason, who of course starred with Steve Carell in The Patient, see, it all goes together, trust me, everything's all connected, hashtag it's all connected, to star in the next iteration of, again, The Office, which remains in development, permanent development, year 15 or 20 of development at this point.
That's real development Universal for the past year.
It's a bit
versus Universal, quote unquote, being open to explorations.
Waves of development. Anyway, Daniels is expected to shoot a pilot before the studio shops the potential series.
On the broadcast side, NBC's Law & Order Organized Crime, the lone Dick Wolf show that was left out of the 5-series renewal at the network, will move to streamer Peacock for what I'm told is a 10-episode 5th season. In other broadcast renewal news, CBS has picked up The Equalizer for a 5th season and has ordered Sheriff Country, a spinoff of Fire Country, not for the upcoming 24-25 season, but for the 25-26 season. And we'll have much more to say about that in a segment coming up this episode.
We're going to have much more to say about Sheriff Country?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's exclusively a Sheriff Country segment, not at all about CBS and no schedule or anything.
This could be fun because I assure you, I have nothing at all to say about Sheriff Country. So I can only assume that since Fire Country is about convicts enlisted to Fire Force, that Sheriff Country is about convicts joining the Sheriff's Department. Whatever. You'll explain it all to me. I look forward to that segment.
No, I'm not going to explain it all. I have no idea.
Okay, excellent.
It's a spinoff of it. So who knows? They already had a backdoor pilot. If you're into the show, you've already seen it. You already know what it is. If you're not, it's on the website.
Trust me, I know some people are fans and God bless. So anyway, that's happy news. Let's move to a little bit of sad news for all the NCIS Hawaii fans out there. I'm not sure I actually know any of them, but according mathematically to the ratings for the show, a good number of people are. And CBS has canceled NCIS Hawaii after 3 seasons. You could have told me that that show was in its first season or in its 17th, and I would have been equally willing to accept your answer. So. In any case, the network has already picked up a prequel series to the franchise in NCIS Origins, which will air alongside the flagship series and the offshoot NCIS Sydney. And NCIS Hawaii joins recently canceled CBS series, including CSI Vegas and So Help Me Todd.
And we will definitely have a considerable amount to say about CBS coming up. But before we get to that, an up second this week. Lots of changes underway at CBS parent Paramount Global.
Number 2.
This week, Paramount Global CEO Bob Bakish, who's been in that role since 2016 and overseen the consolidation of the company after it re-merged with Viacom, has been pushed out as the company continues to explore sales talks. In its place, Paramount has tapped 3 top executives, CBS's George Cheeks, film chief and Nickelodeon boss and director of Varsity Blues, Brian Robbins, and the network's chief Chris McCarthy. I'm just going to keep talking about how powerful the director of Varsity Blues now is in Hollywood. Like, seriously, who would have thought when he made Varsity Blues?
I don't want your laugh. I love that movie. It's got James Vanderbeek in it. Of course I love it.
We know you are a James Vanderbeek fan. I slipped a Varsity Blues reference into my review of Apple's Dark Matter, which will probably pop up next week online, and we'll see if it's still there after it's been edited. So anyway, yes, head of the class star, Ron Robbins, network chief, Chris McCarthy, covered all that. They will serve in the office of CEO as discussions with indie studio Skydance, It's a Wonderful Night for a Skydance, continue for potential sale / merger. Leslie, what does it mean? Or do you just want to sing Moondance to us?
I'm not going to sing. But we should also note that today, or Thursday, Sony and Apollo also threw their hat in the ring with a $26 billion cash offer to buy Paramount Global. So honestly, should a deal with Skydance, who is in the exclusive negotiating window right now, come to fruition, David Ellison's company would likely take over Paramount Global and implement a new strategy for the company. But in the larger sense, it's hard to talk about this because there's obviously not a deal just yet and everyone's still working things out. But with any sale, a new regime would likely change course. And when Backish came in, obviously he had to reposition the company for the streaming future. So Chris McCarthy became his go-to. McCarthy, if you'll remember, started out as a former VH1 executive and slowly but surely added every single linear cable network to his purview. And so he wound up replacing every exec. So you used to have so many of these top media executives that were all part of Viacom, and now the vast majority of them are gone, right? Like Nevins is long gone from Paramount and Showtime, and you had all the execs at Comedy Central. Kent Alterman was gone. You know, McCarthy replaced everyone, and then basically all these cable networks stopped making originals and basically just became second windows for syndicated shows or stuff that aired elsewhere, low-cost acquisitions, because it was about right-sizing the company, right? And everyone wanted to consolidate and prioritize streamers and everything else. But what's interesting now is that before these three executives, George Cheeks, Chris McCarthy, and head of the classes, Brian Robbins, took over, the trio really collaborated and they really kind of had their separate lanes. So they would all kind of feed into content for Paramount Plus through their respective divisions. So Brian Robbins continues to oversee film and Nickelodeon. Cheeks is CBS proper, as along with news. And McCarthy continues to be all the other linear networks, including as well as MTV Entertainment Studios. But honestly, this is really going to be a big question for what happens when you have a company like Paramount Global that is so hugely invested in linear at a time when no one's really watching linear. You know, CBS took a big victory lap this week for winning the 23-24 broadcast season. And it's, I believe it's like their 16th in a row. It snapped their own record from decades ago, you know, but it's also like, really, we're going to present a fall schedule, but it's like, we'll get into that in the next topic. But like, really, what's going to happen to all these networks? What do you do when you are so heavily vested in linear, when you can't get resources and you're cutting back and you're cutting successful shows like NCIS Hawaii, as well as CSI Vegas, which is a spinoff of a hugely important franchise for that network. But you can't put those shows on Paramount, right? Because everyone's budget cutting everywhere, right? And you got to lower the costs of everything and, you know, be more fiscally responsible with pilots and all your other spending. But what do you do with this company? That's what I'm really curious about. So in terms of what does this mean? And right now, it's a giant question mark. And, you know, getting into our next segment.
Number three.
George Cheeks was joined by CBS Entertainment President Amy Reisenbach to present the network's fall schedule at a nice little presser over at the Paramount offices in Hollywood on Thursday afternoon. I went to that and it was obviously, it's always nice to get FaceTime with key executives, but they really did take a victory lap for winning the entire 23-24 broadcast season after it was obviously so impacted by the strikes. But Cheeks really didn't talk a whole lot about the potential sale of Paramount Global, but he kind of addressed the elephant in the room and said that everyone's kind of chugging through and continuing to plan for long-term strategies. But it's also kind of a giant question of, well, those strategies could very well change. So Dan mentioned in headlines that Sheriff Country received a series order for the 25-26 broadcast season. Did you mention that or did I mention that? I don't know. We mentioned that.
I think I mostly expressed incredulity that it existed. I think you had actual news.
Right. So they ordered that for 25-26. And look, that's a great strategy. You know, Amy said that, and I should say, you know, hats off to Amy. She is a noted friend of the five. So thank you for supporting the podcast. And hopefully we'll have her on one of these days. But, you know, she did say she literally pulled a Kevin Riley and declared pilot season was dead. Like CBS is no longer going to be in that pilot space. But instead, you know, as she said, they do long-term development now. So when you look at a show like Tracker, the Justin Hartley vehicle, in which, as you say, he's shirtless quite often, that was developed in pilot season 2022. And that became the number one new show of this past broadcast season. So look, they took their time with it. They got it right. They're going to implement that strategy, but it also means that they're going to save millions and millions of dollars by not making 10 or 12 different comedy and drama pilots every year between January and May and trying to get the best directors and fighting for sound stages and cast and everything else at a time when everyone else is doing it at the same time. So we've talked about on the show before how that no longer makes economic sense in this current era of contraction. But what happens when they have a new parent company? Does this strategy change? That's one of the big questions that I have going in, because how do you make people care about linear? And look, they stress that how much their shows perform, not just on linear, but also on Paramount Plus, where the episodes are available to stream the next day. And we get it. Everyone's watching on streaming, and your shows in this day and age, everyone wants big, broad shows that can reach a massive global audience. That's the bread and butter of what CBS has done for years. So it's really no surprise to see them continuing with this strategy. But in terms of long-term development, yeah, I mean, good for them for saving money. Good for them for not tormenting a shit ton of writers and directors and producers and actors for trying to jam through a pilot and make something good in 4 or 5 months. But again, you're looking at spending and how that's going to impact for broadcast. I mean, to me, Max still has one of the greater strategies, because if you want to watch an HBO show, it's on Max at the exact same moment. If you don't have HBO and you know that a show like House of the Dragon airs Sundays at 9 p.m. and you don't have HBO, but you have Max, you don't have to miss out. You don't have to wait till the next day. It's a great strategy. Day and date, same minute. Like, you want it, it's here. So at some point, I think everyone's going to have to adapt to that strategy, but for now, it remains the next day. But lots more to talk about with CBS. But I feel like I'm monologuing here, Dan.
But you kind of have to, because this was not a full-fledged upfront. It was not technically upfront week. It wasn't presented as an upfront presentation. Typically with upfront presentations, they're live streaming the events all around the country for ad type people who are all around the country and not there. This was not that. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being all of the ridiculous excess of upfronts for decades and decades, and 1 being sending out a press release, where would you say this event was on the spectacle slash event scale?
I mean, it wasn't really like meant to be an event type thing, you know, like this wasn't like put on my fancy outfits and walk the giant stage at Carnegie Hall. This was George and Amy sitting in a room with a PowerPoint presentation. We got to see a bunch of different trailers for a lot of the new stuff that they have coming, both on the scripted as well as unscripted. And honestly, it wasn't really well attended. I don't know how many people they invited. It was obviously invitation only, but I think there were 8 or 9 different outlets there, maybe 10. It was hard to say, but either way, it was FaceTime with execs, one of Amy's first times presenting their schedule. And they had a lot to talk about. I mean, Wall Street Journal was there, but I mean, they don't really care about a CBS fall schedule or pilot season being dead. They care about the sale talks. And you got a couple of quotes from George about morale, you know, about saying everyone at the company is linking arms and focusing on doing things that they can control, which is making great programming. But if you were going there to look for insight about the sale process, you weren't going to get it. So this was largely just focused on programming and ball schedule and really just taking a victory lap for their excellent season this year.
Well, sort of continuing with the idea of kind of the scale of announcements. Obviously, when Kevin Riley made his big pilot season is dead announcement.
That was at TCA. He came out on stage. I can't remember if that was the year he rode the bike out on stage. I don't think it was. I think that was later. But he had a graphic of a tombstone that it literally just said RIP pilot season. And I don't think that that's the case. I think CBS, you know, what they've said is when you look at the Young Sheldon spinoff, so I think it's the sequel to the prequel, as Amy called it, they are going to continue to hand out straight to series orders from trusted partners. So that's from Chuck Lorre. You think Chuck Lorre needs to make a pilot in 2024 for a show that's literally the third show in the franchise? I'm pretty sure he knows those characters by now, right? So at the same time, you know, they're going to continue doing what they did with a show like Watson, which is set in the Sherlock Holmes universe. It stars Morris Chestnut. It was developed as part of a script to series route. So that meant that they opened up a mini room or a so-called development room, paid some writers to come up with a few scripts, probably a series Bible, found the right cast, and it triggered a series order. You know, and honestly, it's a smarter way to make television, you know, and I'm not saying that there's not values in making a pilot. When you look at Sheriff Country, that's for 25, 26. We're heading into 24, 25. So you've got ample time, not just to get the creative right, but to get the casting right, to get the marketing, everything else right. And that's what they stressed about this development approach. So I think you're going to still see some different places make pilots when it's either a format of something that they're trying, or it's a new voice, or they're not entirely sure it's going to work. Like animated shows often get pilot presentations instead of a full-on series order to start. I think it's contingent on the project, right? And the creatives behind it. So again, Chuck Lorre, I don't think he really needs to make a pilot for CBS at this point in his career. But I think Netflix doing script to series on a live action dramatic take on Scooby-Doo, it makes sense to do that with a safety net. So did I answer your question, Dan? I kind of dovetailed a little bit.
Well, I mean, you absolutely answered my question. And I think I actually finished my question. It wasn't an interesting question regardless, mostly just whether the degree to which it feels notable and newsy to say something like that in 2024 versus the degree it felt noisy and newsworthy for Kevin Riley to say it. Because, you know, like you, I remember that big pronouncement vividly, and I don't reference it as often as you do. I don't know if you reference it more or less than you reference the TV set, but you know, it's one of your favorites.
Well, I mean, it was such a moment in time, because like I talked about on our last episode when we did the whole broadcast check-in, the days of making, you know, in the ballpark of 100 pilots annually, those are long gone. And I think Kevin was onto something at that time. He was right. You know, I mean, it's a lot of the stuff that he tried to develop with the script to series model, or went straight to series and then tried to go backwards and like, okay, we got to get through the scripts and then we get the casting and then we film it. And it turned out not to be good. I mean, there were a number of shows that they tried that development approach with that didn't work. But you look at what Fox is doing now and it's the same thing, right? So now you've got CBS doing it. NBC's been doing it. I mean, they still have a couple pilots in the works, but you know, this is a very interesting time that we're at in our industry, especially for broadcasts. Because of the contraction, because everyone wants to focus on right-sizing their slates and their spending, it makes sense to not spend millions and millions of dollars on shows that are never going to make it to air. Like, you don't need to make 10 pilots anymore because you're not going to have 10 slots on the schedule unless you do something insane, right? So CBS knows what they have. You have a couple of shows for their fall schedule that were held back from last year that were ordered to series a year ago because of the strikes. And obviously that delayed writing and production. So when you've got a lineup for next season that already has a couple of things that have been in the works for months, you don't need a lot of stuff. And I think they're realizing that that's a smarter way to work. And as for their actual schedule, I mean, you know, we can get into a discussion about how much time slots matter, but I'm just going to run things down. Monday, The Neighborhood, Papa's House, which is the new Wayans comedy, NCIS, NCIS Origins. Tuesday is all three FBI shows. Wednesday, fall, you've got Survivor and the new reality competition series, The Summit, which looks intriguing. Come January, CBS is plotting to do like a bridge between the fall and mid-season slates with a bunch of game shows. It's The Price is Right at Night, Raid the Cage, and the newly announced Hollywood Squares update with Drew Barrymore in the center square. Then come mid-season, you've got Survivor and the return of The Amazing Race. Thursday, the Young Sheldon spinoff, which is now formally titled Georgie and Mandy's First Marriage, followed by Ghosts. Matlock, which is the Kathy Bates take on that beloved series, followed by Elsbeth. Friday in the fall, SWAT, Fire Country, and the final season of Blue Bloods. Mid-season brings NCIS Sydney at 8, followed by Fire Country and SWAT moving back to 10 p.m. Saturday, you've got 48 Hours airing at 10 p.m., and that's after 2 hours of CBS Encores. Sunday, 60 Minutes, followed by Tracker, which makes the move to open the night at 8 p.m., followed by The Equalizer and Watson come mid-season at 10 p.m. So, Dan, do you think scheduling still matters? I mean, we've talked about this for a long time, but I'm curious to hear your current thoughts.
I think it still can matter. I don't think it necessarily needs to matter, but if it didn't matter, then they wouldn't, for example, do a night of FBI shows. You know, that's them saying putting these shows together causes them to do better than having them do separately, because then otherwise someone would say, well, you know, they could anchor nights and all of that. No, it obviously doesn't mean what it used to. And I think it's much more conditional now. I think that it can still help to have a lead in. It can still get eyeballs. What people do after that is something completely different. But no, I don't. And also, what matters on CBS doesn't matter with everyone else. That is, CBS plays by a different set of rules. And CBS has, and this is not just the CBS audience is old, because that's kind of a hoary cliche, and I don't think it's particularly relevant or meaningfully true. I think the broadcast linear television watching audience is on the older side. But I think things matter to the CBS audience that don't necessarily matter to everyone else. And that part of why CBS is on whatever this ridiculously long winning streak is that, say what you will for whether you like the shows that are on CBS, CBS knows its audience extremely well. And CBS has known its audience extremely well for the most part, honestly, since I've been doing this job. You know, I started doing this job when CBS was at the beginning of that winning streak, and the winning streak was interrupted only briefly when Fox had American Idol. Basically, that was the sort of the early years of Idol when that was the peak. But CBS knows its audience. If every other network knew its audience as well as CBS did, the landscape would probably look and feel different, but they don't. And so CBS knows its audience. They know its audience somewhat cares about time slots in a way that maybe the Fox audience doesn't. But yeah, so it's not a blanket answer on whether time slots matter, but time slots certainly can matter. And this seems like as viable a version of time slots mattering as you're going to get.
Absolutely. And on the cancellation front, you know, Amy and George were asked about if there would be a SWAT situation, meaning a final season announcement followed by an uncancellation, a surprise renewal, that what is going to happen with Blue Bloods, and if there was any chance that NCIS Hawaii could come back. Same with So Help Me Todd or CSI. And all of them, they said, these are canceled. These are not moving to Paramount Plus. Cheek said that they have obviously limited budgeting issues, and it's not an unlimited shelf space at the streamer. And Amy did confirm that they are indeed working on a new incarnation of CSI, because the show continues to be one of the most watched properties on Pluto, which I thought was really interesting.
By that, she means the streaming service, and not that it has a very large audience of aliens on the tiny, tiny planet, which may or may not be a planet this week, of Pluto. Just in case anyone was concerned, we do not know.
It's not being broadcast on Pluto the dog.
Exactly. That would be another possibility. We know as much about the ratings for television shows being watched on the planet of Pluto as we know about actual ratings on Netflix.
Yeah.
I'm Victoria Cash. Thanks for calling the Lucky Land Hotline. If you feel like you do the same thing every day, press 1. If you're ready to have some serious fun for the chance to redeem some serious prizes, press 2.
We heard you loud and clear. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com right now and play over 100 social casino-style games for free. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Up next.
Number four.
April's officially in the books, and as we turn the page to May, lots of scripted stuff on the way. I'm just going to run down some of the highlights. Season 3 of Hacks arrives on Max. Peacock has The Tattooist of Auschwitz. Welcome to Wrexham returns for season 3 with on FX on Hulu. Star Wars Tales of the Empire is on Disney Plus. Dark Matter arrives on Apple TV. Black Twitter: A People's History debuts on Hulu. Bodkin on Netflix, which is executive produced by the Obamas. I think it's their first scripted foray. Pretty Little Liars Summer School returns to Max. You've got the new Doctor stepping in on Doctor Who on Disney Plus. Season 2 of Interview with the Vampire on AMC. Bridgerton, one of my mom's favorites, returns for its third season on Netflix. The Big Cigar on Apple TV. And then Evil, the fourth and final season on Paramount Plus. And we wrap up with one of our favorites here at The Five, We Are Lady Parts, season 2 on Peacock. Dan, it feels a little bit crowded.
Oh, no, it's not. That's that's a wrong feeling.
Maybe it's just looking at this long list and all these high profile shows, but Bridgerton and Hacks, that's big.
Those are a couple shows that people like. And look, it's not a horrible month of television. But on the other hand, if I've been saying over and over again for multiple years now that, you know, the end of spring has become what the end of fall and winter is for movies, the end of spring for television, rather, as a sort of set up ground for Emmy season, then by that standard, May feels really sparse to me. That's my reaction looking at May, is that there's a surprising number of TV shows that are actually premiering at the beginning of June, basically getting out ahead of next year's Emmy season. Some of them extremely high profile, like Jake Gyllenhaal Presumed Innocent. That's a big deal of a TV series premiering in April. So, you know, next year's Emmys. FX has the LA Clippers series also premiering in June, not premiering in May. And, you know, look, if you're both Apple and your FX, there's only so much that you can campaign for any given award. So at some point you have to be like, okay, we're FX and we know that our limited series spend for this year, Emmys, is going to have to go to Fargo and it's going to have to go to Shogun. And so anything else is going to be secondary. So let's put some stuff in June. And Apple kind of has a similar overflow, though I don't necessarily know that everything is as viable in terms of contending. But no, I look at this month and like between May 10th and I'm looking down the list and like May 26th, there's almost nothing new that's premiering. There's The Big Cigar, the Huey Newton Apple TV limited series with Andre Holland, and that ought to be interesting. I'm very curious about it. But in that period, it's a lot of things coming back that absolutely have fans. You know, new season of Interview with the Vampire, of course people are going to be psyched with that. New season of Bridgerton, of course people are going to be psyched by that. New season of Amazon's Josh Brolin's Hole, people are going to be excited for that, as excited as people are likely to be for Josh Brolin's Hole.
Just keep saying Josh Brolin's Hole.
I'm going to. Don't worry. I'm much more likely to keep saying it than to actually watch it, though I guess I'll probably check it out. But no, seriously, there's like a 2 week period where there's nothing new premiering. And that's like the new things premiering in that window include a Shane Gillis comedy on Netflix, which, you know, exactly the face you're making if people could see it. and a couple documentaries, Ashley Madison, Sex, Lies, and Scandal. TLC has something that I keep writing down called Bosch Bariatrics, mostly because it just makes me go, ah! And that's about all that. So I keep writing it down, but like, I'm not going to watch it or review it. It's for the same people who enjoy watching pimples being popped on television. And that's awesome. There's a huge audience for that, but there are a bunch of kind of follow-up series. So Pretty Little Lies, Liars, the summer school thing is a second season to the sequel series or something. Again, if you're the audience for it.
We are not the demo for that show.
Yes, exactly. If you are the audience for it, you're the audience for it, and that's awesome. But the question of whether it's going to move the needle in meaningful ways across the board, I don't know. You know, I think without any question, people are excited about Shuti Gatwa as the Doctor in the new season of Doctor Who. It got people excited in the Christmassy introductory seasons. Is it going to draw a bigger audience than Doctor Who draws? I feel as if for the most part, Doctor Who, you know, its audience is its audience, but people are excited. So that's awesome. But, you know, look at us. We're pumped for We Are Lady Parts season two, because we've only been spending two solid years going, where's our season two of We Are Lady Parts? Well, okay. End of May. There it is. Yay. But, you know, there are a couple documentary things at the end of the month that are interesting. Disney Plus has both a Beach Boys documentary and a Jim Henson documentary directed by Ron Howard. Those seem like things that I will watch. But like in terms of big, bold, new shows and even big, bold, new limited series, it feels like it's a kind of a sparse month. I'm very curious about Bodkin. It looks interesting. But like, do I expect it to be a breakout smash? I wouldn't think so, but you know, no one saw Baby Reindeer coming, so who knows? Evil season four, do want to mention the first couple seasons of Evil are now on Netflix. And I think that there's a very real possibility that that's a kind of a Netflix effect kind of show, and that it could turn out that people suddenly discover Evil, and they're, you know, both the TV show and doing Evil, and that they, you know, that suddenly the final season actually gets the juice that it frankly deserves, but that, you know, neither CBS nor Paramount Plus has effectively been able to give it. It's a really, really good show. So it would not surprise me if people are finding Evil as the clock counts down to May 23rd and then suddenly there's actually a big audience out there for Evil. So yeah, but looking at this month, it is, to me, it's a strange month. There's, you know, so like when I wrote down this list, just going over stuff for my colleague Angie and I to review, Angie and me to review, us to review, etc. Billy and Molly, an otter love story on Nat Geo. It sounded amusing enough that I wrote it down. Zillow Gone Wild. I've seen a couple ads for it at various points. It looks probably like it's funny. I like the concept. There's whatever the live comedy thing is that John Mulaney is presenting / hosting, etc. So there is stuff this month, but honestly, when I actually tabulated it, I was a little disappointed by how much prestige type stuff there is, just given the way that we've presented May as being in recent years. You know, there's stuff I'm looking forward to here.
Yeah, I mean, and there's probably going to be some new trailers that pop out of upfronts, and who knows what's going to come out of those, because Netflix is crashing upfronts again this year, and there's always some surprises at those things. So more than anything, there's, you know, it's a great month if you're a fan of comedy. The Netflix is a Joke Festival is ongoing now here in Southern California. I'm going to see Brett Goldstein a week from Friday. I'm super excited about that.
Wait,
sorry,
who?
I meant
who?
Two-time Emmy-winning actor, Brett Goldstein.
And friend of the five.
Yes. But not BFF of the five.
No, definitely not.
Yeah. So honestly, it's like a lot of the stuff that I'm really looking forward to is all in the comedy space, especially after watching Baby Reindeer. Yeesh.
Oof. Baby Reindeer, which it should be noted, is kind of a comedy. It's just not a funny comedy.
Yeah, that was hard. That was a hard watch. Don't watch that before bed if you're going to watch that. Creepy. Anyway, that's May.
Number five.
Up next, as usual, we wrap things up with the Critics' Corner. Among this week's major new launches, The Veil arrives on Hulu. Netflix has A Man in Full. Hacks is back for season 3 on Max. And Welcome to Wrexham returns on FX on Hulu. Dan, what do you got?
Let's see. I'll save Hacks for the end because you've actually watched it also. So even though you are not a critic, you'll be able to weigh in. I would have reviewed The Veil last week if we'd had a podcast, but I'll get to it this week. Quickly, my aforementioned review of Dark Matter that may or may not still include a joke about Varsity Blues, we'll see. That review will not be up till next week, and I don't want to bigfoot it at all. All I'll say is that the show is not smart enough for how seriously it takes itself. It takes itself very, very, very exhaustingly seriously. That being said, some people like sci-fi that takes itself exhaustingly seriously. Dark Matter will be a TV show for you. As for The Veil, it has already premiered. And so, you know, some people, I don't know that I've actually seen anybody out in the wild talking about it. And I think that may end up continuing to be the case. The truth is that the first two episodes, this is one of those shows that we formerly would have called FX on Hulu. Instead, it's now FX's The Veil airing on Hulu or something to that effect. Whatever it is, John Landgraf would tell us that it's not as confusing as we choose to make it, but we definitely still choose to make it confusing. The first two episodes have already premiered on Hulu. And the truth is, if you've enjoyed it, and totally viable if you do, the first half of the season was easily my favorite half of the season. And then I thought that the second half of the season was actually pretty bad, unfortunately. This is one that for sure, if you were only tepid on it initially, I am definitely not telling you to keep going with it. But if you're curious, maybe your affection for the first couple episodes will weather whatever. Some of the positive reviews that I glanced at praised it particularly for being a thing that it only is for like half of the show. And that to me seems like not a thing to praise a show for. But what do I know? For people who don't know, the show is created by Stephen Knight, who, of course, created Peaky Blinders and also All the Light We Cannot See and the strange Christmas Carol that FX aired a couple of years ago that was really, really bad. Elizabeth Moss plays a character who calls herself Imogen, but it's made very clear from the first scene that it is not actually her real name. She is an MI6 agent, because she does have a British accent here, who is sent out because at a refugee camp on the Syrian-Turkish border, there have been reports of a woman who people are identifying as a major ISIS operative and rumors of an upcoming terrorist attack on the United States that woman may be involved with. That woman, played by Yumna Marwan, insists that she's just Adila, a Parisian woman who was lumped into being an ISIS underling, but in no way is a person of any power or any influence and doesn't want to be involved. Elizabeth Moss's character, her skill is getting people to tell her the truth, and not in a torturey way. She builds relationships and sucks the truth out of people, or something to that effect. She is working hand in glove with a French intelligence agent, Malik, who she also happens to be sleeping with. He is played by Dali Bensala. And the case is about to get blown all to hell because the Americans are about to come in and take over, playing the lead American, who is described basically as the most American whoever American. He's played by Josh Charles, and he's at least having a lot of fun. The thing that people who like the show are praising it for is the relationship between the characters played by Elizabeth Moss and Yumna Marwan. They spend a lot of time in the first couple episodes in the refugee camp and then driving across Turkey, driving towards Istanbul. And the scenes with them in the car and the scenes subsequently with them in Istanbul, in Paris, simply talking, when the show is a two-hander, it is very good. Elizabeth Moss is very good. Yumna Marwan, who I don't think I've ever seen before in anything. Perhaps I have, but I don't remember. She's a Lebanese actress. She's very good. The problem is that's not what the show is. And the second half of the show becomes less and less and less that. So I'm not going to praise the show for being a great two-hander for these two people when the show decides by its last two episodes that it has no interest whatsoever in being those things. The finale, which is twice as long as any other episode in the show, it focuses on a bunch of characters who we either hadn't met before or we barely met, and it marginalizes the characters who you like and whose relationships you think are interesting. So no, I'm not going to praise the show for being an effective two-hander if the show saw that it was being an effective two-hander and decided it didn't want to be that anymore. So I was really frustrated by the last couple episodes of The Veil. It just not surprising, not interesting, selling out all of the things that are interesting in its main characters. Just really, ultimately, a disappointment after starting out as something very promising. Also disappointing is A Man in Full on Netflix, which is the very long gestating adaptation of Tom Wolfe's 1998 novel. If you want to talk about, again, the opposite of striking while the iron is hot, that would be adapting a novel that in 1998 was really, really buzzy for 2 months and deciding to do that in 2024. And that's what A Man in Full is. Part of how it avoids that being an issue is that really David E. Kelly, who's adapting it, has no particular interest in the Tom Wolfe novel. It has very little of the plot of the Tom Wolfe novel. It has very little of the tone of the Tom Wolfe novel at only 6 episodes and most of them on the short side. It has none of the scale and excess of the Tom Wolfe novel. What it does have is a spectacular cast. Jeff Daniels plays Charlie Croker, an Atlanta real estate magnate who's about to be brought down because he's in $1 billion worth of debt to several banks. And you have some great actors playing the various bankers who are trying to bring him down. Bill Camp, always fantastic. Love watching Bill Camp. Tom Pelfrey plays the other banker, a loan officer trying to bring him down. He's appealingly weaselly. You have Diane Lane as Charlie Croker's wife, ex-wife rather. She's pretty good. The show does take some effort to smooth out some of the aspects of the Tom Wolfe novel that were at the time most quote-unquote controversial or problematic or whatever. There's a lot of Tom Wolfe trying with very, very little success to capture the tone and flavor of the African-American community in Atlanta circa 1998. Tom Wolfe's ear for hip-hop, one of the most out-of-touch things any writer has ever attempted, with possible competition from Tom Wolfe's attempt to write like a teenage girl in the book that came after this in I Am Charlotte Simmons, which was just astonishingly bad. In general, I liked the book, though, of A Man in Full. It's got flaws, but it also has big ideas about wealth and cultural friction in Atlanta in the late 90s. All of that's gone. None of the depth of the book, none of the excess and opulence and grotesquery of wealth are here. It's just flat and it's well acted. It's flat, isn't funny. It gets so little of Tom Wolfe's cynical eye. Yeah, big disappointment, not a surprising disappointment. But anyway, so let's get to some better stuff. Welcome to Wrexham is back. And Welcome to Wrexham remains one of my true general pleasure shows. It's just a show that I like sitting down to watch. It is simultaneously a very good and thoroughly effective sports documentary. I cheer. I get misty in all of the ways that a good underdog sports story gets. And it still continues to be effectively an underdog sports story, even though by no stretch of the imagination is Wrexham an underdog anymore. That's the sort of funny undercurrent here, is that these two Hollywood bigwigs, Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds, came in and were successfully able to resuscitate a slightly moribund football team, soccer, whatever you want to call it, by pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into it. There is no secret whatsoever to what they did. They came in with tens of millions of dollars and they poured it into the stadium. They poured it into players who under no other circumstance would have played for a low-tier Welsh football team. And suddenly the team got good. And it's not shocking that they did. What's shocking is that the series can still treat it like it is an underdog story, that they can still find the ties to the community of Wrexham that make you think sympathetically about what really ought to be kind of a behemoth kind of team. You know, obviously they're not Manchester United, but still in all, they're working on a level that most teams at that level cannot work because they don't have movie stars fronting the franchise. And the fact that they have been successful since Robin Ryan took over is not hugely surprising. It still is very satisfying. I think the show still does a great job with the characterizations. One thing I will say, because I have to always throw in a but ... clause, because I tend to be a negative guy, except for when I love things. And even then, sometimes these episodes, I've seen only the first three episodes of the new season, they feel a little rushed and they feel a little less structured than the first couple of seasons. The first couple of seasons, there was no set format to the show, and I found that incredibly appealing. Episodes could be 21 minutes if that's how much story they had, if that's the focus they wanted to have. Episodes could be 40 minutes if it was a bigger thing. It just didn't matter. It could be whatever it wanted to be. These episodes were all, for this new season, the three episodes I've seen, they're all 43 minutes. They all feel a little long. They all feel a little loosely edited. They don't have as much focus as the first couple seasons had. But they still work. They still play. I still love when they spend time with the women's team, which came into the picture in the second season. I think that is such a good story. And they still are kind of an underdog story. And I love that story. But I love cheering for Super Paul Mullen. I love all of that. I really enjoy Welcome to Wrexham. It's just a good version of the thing that it's trying to be. And then, last, and definitely by no stretch of the imagination least, the third season of Hacks, a show that apparently I like it less than the people who love it most, but I really like it a lot. So when I say I like Hacks a lot, as opposed to I love Hacks a lot or whatever, that's not a criticism. I really enjoy Hacks. Hacks is really good. To me, watching Gene Smart and Hannah Einbinder remains a tremendous amount of fun. And the first couple episodes of this season, to me, felt not bumpy, but they felt a little repetitive. They felt a little thin. Around mid-season, whether it was timed with the hiatus that they took when Gene Smart had medical issues or whatever, the show finds a darker and more emotional vein that I don't think it had explored so fully. There's a lot of talk about sort of mortality and last chances. Just so much poignance to Gene Smart, who is one of those actors. She's kind of in that Julie Louis-Dreyfus category of, yes, they have many, many Emmys at this point, but you can't begrudge that fact because they're so good. So watching Gene Smart is always fun. Hannah Einbinder keeps getting better each season. I think first season, maybe like the first four episodes, little on the wooden side, little figuring herself out as she goes. There was the episode with the tragedy in Las Vegas that was midway through the first season. And that to me is kind of the turning point for her as an actress. It's a turning point for, honestly, the series. It's showing what it could do. And I think she's great. And I think she has some of her best dramatic acting this season. There are more cameos than I could list or than I would ever want to spoil. Big classic TV stars, big recent TV stars, funny in-jokes. If you are a Television Critics Association member, a whole episode that's set at the Langham in Pasadena, where they're just going through the Langham in Pasadena. It's just like, yay, it's like being at press tour. Yeah, so I thought the second half of the season was probably the show at its very best. I think that the eighth episode, to me, felt right on the edge of being like a series finale, which is the thing that the show has done before. The show could have ended at the end of the first season. The show could have ended at the end of the second season. I think the show could have ended after the eighth episode of the third season. After the ninth episode of the third season, I was ready for a fourth season. So that's kind of where I went with this. Yeah, really enjoyed Hacks. Really glad to have it back. It felt like it had been too long. the first episode back jumps forward a year. So it's sort of simultaneously being like, it doesn't matter if you remember where exactly we left things off, but then you have to kind of remember where we left things off. But it fills in the blanks. It's got a little bit of legwork that it has to do in that respect. But yeah, really happy with the new season of Hacks. Leslie, you are not a critic, I've heard, but I also hear that you've watched all of the new season of Hacks. So what you think?
Loved it.
That's all you got?
Loved it. I mean, I think your review is pretty spot on, Dan. It does start a little bit slow. The time jump makes a lot of sense. I love when shows do that because it really does reset everything and they always find a creative way to pick up what the last season cliffhanger was. I will say that it feels like Ava is really learning and progressing and you're starting to see much more of Deborah's impact on her and vice versa. It's just so good. And the finale is, I was like, what? I was screaming at the TV. It was great.
It really does set things up nicely for a fourth season. So
yeah. And you can go and read an excellent interview with the creators of Hacks over at thstarter.com from Friend of the Five and our great colleague, Mikey O'Connell, in which the creators talked about having a 5-season plan for the show.
That seems right. I both hope and assume that they will get to do that. So
yeah, makes a lot of sense.
But yes, Friend of the Five Mikey has been doing a lot of really great interviews lately. So big ups to Friend of the Five Mikey, who rest assured does not actually listen to the Five, but we're still going to say nice things about him anyway, whatever.
Terrific interview recently with John Oliver. Yeah, lots of good stuff.
If you're friends with Mikey and you know he doesn't listen to the podcast, feel free to tell him we were saying nice things about him because we are. So anyway, as the quick recap of Critics Corner goes, The Veil starts off promisingly, but I gotta say, you've basically seen the best of the show, unfortunately. If you've watched the first two episodes, it doesn't go particularly well. And yet, I always like watching Elizabeth Moss. She's as close to a sure thing as you get on television. A Man in Full. I don't know how it works if you don't expect it to be Tom Wolfe. I think if you have no idea what it is, maybe you'll find that you like what it is. But if you expect it to be Tom Wolfe, I think it's a huge disappointment. Not disappointing at all, the return of Welcome to Wrexham, a little bit more shaggy this season. Probably everything needed a little bit more editing, but I'm just glad to have it back. And I understand why they needed to rush it back, because the reality of the situation is spoiling the show. And so they can't just have the show being a year behind on everything when people know what's happening with the team. So I get that. And Hacks, really good new season. Leslie loved it.
A+. For more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Reporter's Now See This newsletter and bookmark thr.com/TV reviews for more. Coming in the next couple of weeks, you'll have Dan's thoughts on Josh Brolin's Hole.
No promises. No promises. I might just decide not to watch it.
Well, that feels like a good place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
Be sure to subscribe on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. They help spread the word of mouth. Come say hi to us on the social medias, as much as we're on the social medias. Leslie is, as always, at Snoodit with 2 O's. I am, as always, at The Fine Print, FIEN. If you have questions for future mailbag segments, though, you should email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That is tvstop5, the numeral 5, at thr.com. Until next week, birthday girl.
Until next week, Josh Brolin's Hole.
Ew!
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say.
Your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.